Content warning, this episode of So Many Books, So Little Time discusses some heavier themes that could be triggering to some listeners, including terminology that is related to causing self-harm and harming others for the intention of protecting them, but it's very complicated and I cannot go into more detail than that without potentially being triggering. Then also the beginning of the podcast, Dave and I have a conversation that goes deeply into purpose and function, and we like feeling worth, as one has worth or not, and that can be potentially also a hard topic to listen to for some people.
Hey folks, Dave here.
Andrew.
And welcome to So Many Books.
So Little Time.
Please join us, won't you, as we continue with Catch 22 by Joseph Heller with Chapter 12, Bologna.
Not Devon.
Now, those who have not heard our previous episode would be wondering about that joke. Of course, now my mind went, who would just listen to this episode without listening to the others? But I bet you're out there.
Yes, yes. So if you don't want to be left out in the cold, you will have to catch up and listen to the previous episode and even the ones before that in order to catch up. You can. I'm not going to reiterate the humor because it is funny to me, but it is not helpful without... We might as well use it as a tag, as a... what's the verbal equivalent of a clickbait? Clickbait for our previous episode. A soundbite? Clickbait? Soundbite? I mean, the... bait? Bite? Why not? That's what we're going to call it. It's a sound bite that should entice you. Because
if you go into fishing parlance, you want the fish to bite the line.
It's fair. That makes sense. I can see the connection. It works.
Ah, yes. It is a Thursday afternoon we are recording. Mm. Today's been a bit all over the place, but it's been fairly quiet where I am. Yourself?
No. They're still removing rubble from the house that was knocked down.
Ah. So it was completely knocked down. It's now demolished.
Yes, a completely demolished house. They're just removing rubble and smoothing out the ground so they can build a new house. But yes, there's some... there's noise, but there's also... I have a lot of internal noise right now. So a lot of, you know, study-related and career-related, like... what am I doing? Why am I doing it? What's the point? Why am I doing it this way? Kind of
that's what existential, you mean by internal voice. Chatter.
Yes, internal chatter.
The monkey mind, I've heard it's called.
Yeah, we're gonna go with that. Yeah, and there's other things going on as well. So it's been a bit of a. It doesn't help that there's this background of increasing. There's just this constant narrative of disregard for people who are physically or mentally requiring maybe support or adjustments or accommodations, aka the disabled community. So the disabled community is getting a lot of repeated messages of being a burden, being... not it, like their safety and health not being as important or a priority, or like whether this be through budgets, which we already know and we already see a lot in terms of but budget wise it's a thing, laws that don't really protect individuals, the generalized approaches, it's all very like a very loud few months of it. I mean, the last year has been rough, but these last few months have been especially loud when it comes to the narrative of being lesser than simply because you aren't a representative of the average population.
I'm feeling that a little. Just I'm experiencing some financial hardships, and it's really flared the internal dialogue of not succeeding at life.
Yeah.
That idea.
And, yeah.
Which we have brought up on this podcast before.
Yeah, we have.
What what the idea of success is. But, you know, despite the, it's an issue I come up a lot being, I guess I've had other people tell me I'm quite analytical. And, but, you know, I've always, there's been a, I can understand something intellectually, but I also can always feel when there's the gulf between understanding something intellectually and feeling it in my heart, which that's the important one for me. Like if it's not there, if what I feel, what I think in my head, if that's not synced up to what I feel in my heart, then it doesn't matter if intellectually I know it to be true, or, you know, I know that what I'm feeling is just, you know, whatever is going on my head and the issues I have, it's still, I can't bring myself out of the funk intellectually because it's an emotional problem.
Yeah. There's been, I mean, it's a lot, as you're saying, like there's that intellectual, emotional kind of disparity, and it's difficult. I think it's also having a lot of external narrative doesn't help.
Oh yeah. Because it's that thing where, I guess the word zeitgeist is kind of what I think here's an interesting idea. How to go into this? So I watch a lot of music theory videos on YouTube, and some of them are quite popular. One of the ones I watch is a guy called Rick Beato. He's a producer. He's now in his late 50s, and he's been making YouTube for a few years now, teaching music, going into what makes certain music great. And he talks a lot about, you know, the industry over the 90s. And there was a video he did not long ago talking about how a lot of the biggest bands of the 90s never crossed the millennial barrier. Like once the 2000s hit, they went out as, a lot of them still make albums, but it's like they weren't in the zeitgeist. And actually that's very similar to, I was thinking of other bands where, like, you know, I'm like, oh yeah, they were huge like back then. And while they probably still have millions of followers, it feels like they're not in the public eye anymore. And it got me thinking how the idea of the zeitgeist really is like something that you just feel. It's like surrounds you. You know, even me, who kind of sticks away from, you know, I don't watch TV all that much, and I try and avoid the news, but still a lot of the stuff, like almost through osmosis, through living in a society, I kind of still know what like the big movies and TV shows are. I kind of know what the big bands are, even if I don't listen to them. And I know when huge stuff is happening around the world, without trying to search it out myself. So yeah, that idea of the way society looks either on disabled or those of us who are having trouble succeeding, as I put in finger quotes, in accordance with the society we live in. It's like that pressure, that expectation, and the failure. It's not literal, but it's like I can feel it in the air. It's there, even if I'm can intellectualize my way out of it. I can't escape it because kind of the societal pressure is something that affects me emotionally.
Yeah, and I'd say, like, I personally tend to differentiate between the societal pressures and the current norms and expectations and habits and patterns and what would maybe be considered the zeitgeist. But then again, my definition and understanding of what zeitgeist is going to be a little different to maybe another person's. And that's because
it's a German word and you know German.
Yeah. Well, no, also because if we leave it up to the general, I want to say, in the parlance of the younger individuals, such as our Gen Z, they like to express it as the vibe. You know, they
vibe's a good word.
Vibe is the word that's now made a resurgence, like to be vibing with something or not vibing with something. There is a general, I guess, vibe or a sense that there is a need for change in the way that we do things, but then there's also complacency, and then there's also change, but at what expense, and change and resistance to change. I mean, that's since the dawn of time, it's change and resistance to change. That is like humanity in a nutshell. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot more to us, but that's the movements that have really keep clashing with each other. And then change at what expense, change with what impact, change thinking about what's going on or not. And again, just because a lot of the current discourse, as I'm going to phrase it, is a lot of the discourse right now that is surrounding disability, that's coming from, say, news, general society, average member of society, politicians and whatnot, because that their kind of language, what's being used, is kind of discouraging, because it feels like being able to be seen as an individual who can contribute, however it is that they contribute to the world, be it simply by existing and caring and seeing themselves as a person and being seen as a person, that in itself is a contribution, because it makes you shift and stop dwelling in your discomfort. I mean, I read a really cool, a screenshot from somewhere, and they pointed out that one of the big things about how people who are in financial distress, people who are ill or chronically ill or disabled, the narrative around that, as soon as you, not everyone is going to speak like this, bearing this in mind, and this is not everyone, it's just we are all very familiar with someone saying, well, why don't you do something about it? Or have you tried this? Or have you tried that? Have you considered this? Like that well-meaning advice, most of the time, not all the time again, that kind of concern, framed in as concern, but the way that it's framed is like, this person is in a state that I could find myself in, but I need to be able to control that. Like the idea that someone can't get over the fact that they could at any moment be in the position of that other person who is quote unquote not succeeding based on what they're going through difficulties or suffering. They see the suffering of another, and instead of going, hey, how can I be supportive? What would be supportive towards alleviating your suffering, and what can we do to like, what are the causes, and can I contribute somehow to not adding to your suffering? No, it's what have you done? Why have you considered this list of things that I control in my life as possibly helping you get out of the suffering, which, because they're afraid, because there's an instinctive fear that, hey, I control all these things, so it has to be one of these things that I'm already controlling in my life. Otherwise, what stops me from becoming them?
And what you said there, like in my own personal circumstance, are there things about myself that I need to work on in order to be better equipped to contribute and play the game of the society I live? Yes. But here's the thing. We all have that. None of us is perfect. Mm. None of us is there. We're always a work in progress. Yes. And it's that fear, but it's also, I guess, people don't want to admit to themselves that there are plenty of examples of people who've done everything the right way and they've gotten nowhere.
Yeah. And arguably, there is also no the right way, and that's the problem. Mm-hmm. It's because they think it's superstition. It's essentially superstition, but taken to the extreme. The superstition in this case being, in the past, we have some generations where they would have run around and you just have to apply to more jobs, and then eventually you'll get your spot. Or if you keep being consistent with your YouTube videos, and someday you'll be discovered if you keep singing those videos. Like, we don't want to admit that a big chunk of it is luck. And yes, of course, mm-hmm. Perseverance increases the probability of having luck. If you have talent and ability and you have persistence and perseverance, then the odds of you being quote unquote discovered, for example, as an artist or a singer or whatever, is higher. But if your only function for your persistence and your perseverance and honing your talent is in order to be discovered, to have your name and fame and whatnot, then it's not going to work out for you, because for every one person that's discovered, how many millions are not?
It won't sustain you either. I think no. Opportunity is like that nexus point of perseverance and luck, because yeah, there's the idea that to be discovered on YouTube, and I'm taking this example that you mentioned because yes, I've been on YouTube 6 years, and
yeah,
considering what I feel I should have, I have a pitiful subscriber base and view count for my videos, and it's only recently actually I've taken a step back from my normal output, and I'm trying to focus more on more long term things, and maybe there's an idea that I've discovered in self-help books a lot, where often the way forward or the way to improve yourself can often be through subtraction, taking away something from your life.
Yes.
But back to the perseverance idea. Like, I think, yeah, the perseverance is important, because if I'm not making YouTube videos, then there's no way I'm ever going to hit the algorithm. The idea that you need to be creating for either the right people or the right confluence of opportunity. And who was I talking about this with not long ago? But the idea that especially those who have made it, I think they grip so tightly onto the idea that they got there themselves, because what I feel is the honest answer, that they were lucky often more than one time. You know, actually, there's a guy I follow on Twitter. He was kind of going through his life, all the kind of things that had to line up to get to where he is. And he's not huge, but he's made a living off what he loves, which is, you know, even that can be, that sounds like nirvana to someone like me.
Yeah.
And he lists like all these things, you know, when I was a kid, this happened. When I was a teenager, this happened. I met this person who led me down this path. And then I met these people and I was this right place, right time. You know, it's not just that one time. It seems to be that link in the chain of opportunity after opportunity after opportunity. And also being in the right place mentally to recognize opportunities as they happen, because they do happen to us all the time. And sometimes we're not in the right place to receive them.
Yeah.
It's scary to think just how much chance plays into, whether you succeed or fail.
And again, succeed or fail by whose standard? Because if you're a person who sees in what they do a way to contribute to the world and a space to like grow and develop and become a stronger person, a kinder person, a more compassionate person, someone who actually connects with others. If that's your ideal of and your purpose and your success, so it depends on what your purpose is. As long as you have purpose and whatever you are doing is aligned with that purpose, that's all that ultimately things. If your purpose is making money, sure, that can be your purpose. If you want that to be a purpose, sure. I'm not going to, it's not for anyone to judge. If your purpose is to do so whilst maintaining integrity and kindness and all these things, it's a harder way to do it. But if you can do that, that's, you know, good on you. If that is your only purpose and there's nothing else about you but that, then, I mean, you can do whatever you wanted to do, whatever you happen to be good at, and just try and keep at it. If it's about creating content that provokes someone's thinking, that someone is uplifted by, makes someone reflect on their own life or consider their own choices or whatever, that can be also your thing. Like, even if one person for 0.003 seconds in their life smiles because of your actions, and that was, if your purpose is to bring joy to another person and that happens, you have brought joy, even if it's just that 0.00 whatever few seconds. I think the point is that if you're contributing to the thing that you are aiming for, if your purpose is there, then that's it. That's it doesn't mean you stop and, okay, cool, I'm done. It just means that you are on your way. You're doing something. It's just that it might not feel like an obvious thing. And it might not be you know, it might, you might not be aware of it until it accumulates.
You might never be aware of it. I don't know if we talked on the podcast, but we've definitely talked in person before about how the idea of leaving a legacy, the problem with that is it's definitely a completely egoic pursuit, because it's not that we want to leave a legacy. We want to see that legacy. We want the accolades of that legacy. Whereas I think it was Rube pointed out to me, you know, I might have touched dozens upon dozens, maybe even hundreds of people throughout my life just by being me. And I'll never see that, but I may have made positive and sadly also negative impacts on people's lives. Because we all, actually, it's funny, I can still remember, like, back to high school, there were people I treated very badly in a moment of anger and fear. And I still kind of remember those instances. And I regret them to this day. Because you know, I remember a lot. I still remember, like, all the times I was treated very badly. I think that kind of thing sticks with us. But yeah, the idea that we don't know the impact we have on others, good or bad.
If we're lucky, we get to witness it. But we don't. We can't, like, that's why legacy is such a funny and loaded word. If legacy is all about you being remembered and what you have accumulated and then can give to others, there's material legacy, there's emotional legacy, there's personal in terms of, like, if you have offspring, if you don't have offspring, that's genetic legacy, I guess, or even adopted. I mean, whatever, it's your family in terms of, that would be your social legacy, I guess, your social and familial and connection legacy, whatever. But in terms of whether you have, you don't know if that person, that kid, if you're a teacher and that kid who was in your, you were a substitute teacher, you popped into a classroom, one kid just asked a really random question about a book and you, that they're assigned and going, look, I really like the fact that you feel confident enough to ask a question, and then you actually encourage them and you praise them, even if it's not like a well done, good job, what a wonderful question, even that little bit of thank you for having the courage to actually speak up and ask a question, and I appreciate that, and it's really good, really important to ask questions, and then take them seriously. That one moment where you've taken that one child seriously in one classroom one time, that can be enough to be the difference between someone who lives and grows up and takes their kids seriously and feels that children should be listened to and taken seriously, and think becomes a child psychologist, who knows what they become, whatever, we don't know. But we know that this is literally how it happens. This is how people grow and develop. It's these series of all these different moments and interactions. And of course, you've got also the continuous things that are in the background, how we're raised, what values we're encouraged to have, and all that as well. But it takes that one instance of being told, hey, you know that thing that you said, that was kind of like, I wasn't comfortable with that. It kind of felt a bit racist to me, and this is why. I'm not saying that you're a bad person, whatever. I'm saying this thing that you just said, it felt racist to me, and this is why. And you have the opportunity, A, to be defensive and grumpy and whatever, and like, oh, I couldn't be, I'm never, my friends are blah, 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 blah. Like, I never see color, I never see, all that kind of defensiveness. Or you can kind of go, oh, okay, well, thank you for letting me know. Let me. Are there any materials I can read? Or like, let me have a think on that.
Or both. Because often the way it goes, at least in the way it's gone when I've been called out, is I will usually have that in the moment defensive posturing, and then I will reflect on that moment later, and over time, I think a lot of these issues are definitely softened on because, someone was able to go, hey, man, not cool.
Yeah. And I mean, and I think for some of us, we respond well to being called out, and some of us respond better to being called in or someone having a gentle conversation, and some of us respond better. And again, this shouldn't be on the people who are actually suffering and being and feeling hurt. So if someone feels like they've been, they feel hurt by someone else's actions, it's not on them to necessarily couch their words in all the fluff needed to get to deal. Most people will just ignore and they'll distance themselves from the person. I mean, that happens a lot.
Which is very viable too. You have no obligation to be around people who make you feel less than.
You're not obliged to be around those that, that make you suffer. At the same time, if you choose to be involved in the education and the at least try and open that option for someone else's path, that is also absolutely a valid choice. Whatever your choice, how you respond to input, how you think, that's depends on what you value in yourself as a person and what how you also set your boundaries and what you can and cannot cope with. And this is bringing us all back to the book, because we have to, because that is why we're here. So Bologna, we have, so far the book has been very jumpy. We know some, Bologna is a, essentially, for lack of a better term, like it's a doomed mission. Like they don't want to go because they know it's lethal. And the chances of them surviving is very slim. And if you... And we know that lots has happened also before then that has been painful and harmful and whatnot. And it's and the attitude that's coming from some of the other officers and such as Black, I was like Captain Black and
oh, all the others. He's a piece of work, isn't he?
Well, yeah, he was terrible. But it's interesting because so the way that we just talk about this, there's one point interactions here and there, one off little things. This book really actually does hone in on that, but in a specific setting and specific, like the, all these little things adding up, the way that, for example, Major's life is built up to the point where he's at.
Yeah. That's a lifetime of, I'd say, negative reinforcement.
Well, it's not just negative reinforcement. It was just like, well, because they don't like him because he looks a bit like Henry Fonda.
And his father named him a stupid name.
And his father, and the reason, yeah. And so like, it's an accumulation. And still, he's not a bad person, per se. He's not like a vindictive, malicious, nasty person like, say, Captain Black. But he's broken. And it's because of a series of things. And of course, Captain Black also contributed to that.
And I think it's also, I don't know, at this point, maybe it's not safe to say, but like, okay. So far, thematically, war makes people crazy. That's pretty front and center, right?
To say that Catch-22 isn't discussing the fact that not only is war futile, it's literally nonsensical and it is harmful to the human psyche and spirit and mind.
But also, and again, maybe we're too early for me to say this definitively, I really get the feeling that alongside the idea of war makes people crazy, there's something about the hierarchy and the power structure of the military that is equally at fault here.
I mean, I'd argue that that's, whether you are in an actual conflict or whether you are not, the hierarchy and the military and all that is still war. It's just not an active war. So it's just war. It all becomes war. It's just the machinery, I guess, the machinery that operates around war, the decisions that occur within conflict, the actual conflicts themselves, everything that is even adjacent to war is detrimental to the human spirit, so to speak. And spirit meaning mind, body, existence, everything.
The general, and I think that played back into the idea of the zeitgeist, because usually, well, at the risk of going off on another tangent, so I'll cut us pretty quickly, but from my understanding, I was not alive for either, but I've read books and watched movies about both World War II and Vietnam, and it seems the general public zeitgeist of both wars was very different. The way the public kind of responded to them and how they felt about the conflict.
Vietnam is a prime example of where things started going. I mean, Korean War was also another one that was a bit of a mess, but it was the treatment of veterans from Vietnam War onwards has been interesting. By interesting, I mean there's a very different attitude towards war towards those who engage in the military. I mean, we have the, with regards to the military industrial complex, we know that the military industrial complex in many nations is part of the backbone of the structure of the economy, part of the backbone in terms of education, in terms of, for many people, they're placed into an economically dire situation where essentially the only way that they can survive or better their existence or even any sort of existence for themselves and their family is to, for example, enroll or enlist. Sorry, enroll, enlist, enlist. Thinking of uni terms, you know, that's which is
I do want to get into another part of that, but I think at this
point... But it's more complex than that. There's also the whole excess patriotism as a and propaganda and all those things as well. So, but let's, I think for now, let's boiling it back down to, or dialing it back down to, in this situation, we had so far we've seen a very, very distorted mindset from people who were there. They're very distorted thinking.
I will be very interested to see in this upcoming chapter whose perspective it is from, because this one's called Bologna. So it's about a time and place rather than a person. And not that means we aren't going to get jumping around, because in chapters that have been titled about people, we've sometimes spent only a little time with that person and jumped to other people. But I think it is time to find out just what happens in this early look at Bologna. Bologna. Actually, it was not Captain Black, but Sergeant Knight who triggered the solemn panic of Bologna, slipping silently off the truck for two extra flak suits as soon as he learnt the target and signaling the start of the grim procession back into the parachute tent that degenerated into a frantic stampede finally before all the extra flak suits were gone. "Hey, what's going on?" Kid Sampson asked nervously. "Bologna can't be that rough, can it?" Nate Lee, sitting trance-like on the floor of the truck, held his grave young face in both hands and did not answer him. It was Sergeant Knight and the cruel series of postponements, for just as they were climbing up into their planes that first morning, along came a jeep with the news that it was raining in Bologna and that the mission would be delayed. It was raining in Pianosa, too, by the time they returned to the squadron, and they had the rest of that day to stare woodenly at the bomb line on the map under the awning of the intelligence tent and ruminate hypnotically on the fact that there was no escape. The evidence was there vividly in the narrow red ribbon tacked across the mainland. The ground forces in Italy were pinned down 42 insurmountable miles south of the target and could not possibly capture the city in time. Nothing could save the men in Pianosa from the mission to Bologna. They were trapped. Their only hope was that it would never stop raining, and they had no hope because they all knew it would. When it did stop raining in Pianosa, it rained in Bologna. When it stopped raining in Bologna, it began again in Pianosa. If there was no rain at all, there were freakish, inexplicable phenomena like the epidemic of diarrhea or the bomb line that moved. Four times during the first 6 days they were assembled and briefed and then sent back. Once, they took off and were flying in formation when the control tower summoned them down. The more it rained, the worse they suffered. The worse they suffered, the more they prayed that it would continue raining. All through the night, men looked at the sky and were saddened by the stars. All through the day, they looked at the bomb line on the big wobbling easel map of Italy that blew over in the wind and was dragged in under the awning of the intelligence tent every time the rain began. The bomb line was a scarlet band of narrow satin ribbon that delineated the forwardmost position of the Allied ground forces in every sector of the Italian mainland. The morning after Hungry Joe's fistfight with Huppel's cat, the rain stopped falling in both places. The landing strip began to dry. It would take a full 24 hours to harden, but the sky remained cloudless. The resentments incubating in each man hatched into hatred. First, they hated the infantrymen on the mainland because they had failed to capture Bologna. Then they began to hate the bomb line itself. For hours, they stared relentlessly at the scarlet ribbon on the map and hated it because it would not move up high enough to encompass the city. When night fell, they congregated in the darkness with flashlights, continuing their macabre vigil at the bomb line in brooding entreaty as though hoping to move the ribbon up by the collective weight of their sullen prayers. "I really can't believe it," Clevenger exclaimed to the Assyrian in a voice rising and falling in protest and wonder. "It's a complete reversion to primitive superstition. They're confusing cause and effect. It makes as much sense as knocking on wood or crossing your fingers. They really believe that we wouldn't have to fly that mission tomorrow if someone would only tiptoe up to the map in the middle of the night and move the bomb line over Bologna. Can you imagine? You and I must be the only rational ones left."
Sure.
In the middle of the night, Yessarian knocked on wood, crossed his fingers, and tiptoed out of his tent to move the bomb line up over Bologna. Corporal Kolodny tiptoed stealthily into Captain Black's tent early the next morning, reached inside the mosquito net, and gently shook the moist shoulder blade he found there until Captain Black opened his eyes. "What are you waking me up for?" whimpered Captain Black. "They've captured Bologna, sir," said Corporal Kolodny. "I thought you want to know. Is the mission canceled?" Captain Black tugged himself erect and began scratching his scrawny long thighs methodically. In a little while, he dressed and emerged from his tent, squinting, cross and unshaven. The sky was clear and warm. He peered without emotion at the map. Sure enough, they had captured Bologna. Inside the intelligence tent, Corporal Kolodny was already removing the maps of Bologna from the navigation kits. Captain Black seated himself with a loud yawn, lifted his feet to the top of his desk, and phoned Colonel Korn. "What are you waking me up for?" whimpered Colonel Korn. "They captured Bologna during the night, sir. Is the mission canceled?" "What are you talking about, Black?" Colonel Korn growled. "Why should the mission be canceled?" "Because they captured Bologna, sir. Isn't the mission canceled?" "Of course the mission is canceled. Do you think we're bombing our own troops now?" "What are you waking me up for?" Colonel Cathcart whimpered to Colonel Korn. "They captured Bologna," Colonel Korn told him. "I thought you'd want to know." "Who captured Bologna?" "We did." Colonel Cathcart was overjoyed, for he was relieved of the embarrassing commitment to bomb Bologna without blemish to the reputation for valor he had earned by volunteering his men to do it. General Dreadle was pleased with the capture of Bologna, too, although he was angry with Colonel Mudis for waking him up to tell him about it. Headquarters was also pleased and decided to award a medal to the officer who captured the city. There was no officer who had captured the city, so they gave the medal to General Peckham instead, because General Peckham was the only officer with sufficient initiative to ask for it. As soon as General Peckham had received his medal, he began asking for increased responsibility. It was General Peckham's opinion that all combat units in the theater should be placed under the jurisdiction of the Special Service Corps, of which General Peckham himself was the commanding officer. If dropping bombs on the enemy was not a special service, he reflected aloud frequently with the martyred smile of sweet reasonableness that was his loyal Confederate in every dispute, then he could not help wondering what in the world was. With amiable regret, he declined the offer of a combat post under General Dreadle. "Flying combat missions for General Dreadle is not exactly what I had in mind," he explained, indulgently with a smooth laugh. "I was thinking more in terms of replacing General Dreadle, or perhaps as something above General Dreadle, where I could exercise supervision over a great many other generals, too. You see, my most precious abilities are mainly administrative ones. I have a happy facility for getting different people to agree." "He has a happy facility for getting different people to agree. What a prick he is," Colonel Cargill confided invidiously to XPFC Wintergreen, in the hope that XPFC Wintergreen would spread the unfavorable report along through 27th Air Force headquarters. "If anyone deserves that combat post, I do. It was even my idea that we ask for the medal." "You really want to go into combat?" XPFC Wintergreen inquired. "Combat?" Colonel Cargill was aghast. "Oh no, you misunderstand me. Of course, I wouldn't actually mind going into combat, but my best abilities are mainly administrative ones. I, too, have a happy facility for getting different people to agree." "He, too, has a happy facility for getting different people to agree what a prick he is," XPFC Wintergreen confided with a laugh to Yessarian after he had come to Pianosa to learn if it was really true about Milo and the Egyptian cotton. "If anyone deserves a promotion, I do." Actually, he had risen already to ex-corporal, having shot through the ranks shortly after his transfer to 27th Air Force Headquarters as a mail clerk and been busted right down to private for making odious audible comparisons about the commissioned officers for whom he worked. The heady taste of success had infused him further with morality and fired him with ambition for loftier attainments. "Do you want to buy some Zippo lighters?" he asked Yusarian. "They were stolen right from Quartermaster." "Does Milo know you're selling cigarette lighters?" "What's it his business? Milo's not carrying cigarette lighters too now, is he?" "He sure is," Yusarian told him, "and his aren't stolen." "That's what you think," XPFC Wintergreen answered with a laconic snort. "I'm selling mine for a buck apiece. What's he getting for his?" "A dollar and a penny." XPFC Wintergreen snickered triumphantly. "I beat him every time," he gloated. "Say, what about all that Egyptian cotton he stuck with? How much did he buy?"
"All."
"In the whole world? Well, I'll be damned." XPFC Wintergreen crowed with malicious glee. "What a dope! You were in Cairo with him. Why'd you let him do it?"
"Me," Yusarian answered with a shrug. "I have no influence on him. It was those teletype machines they have in all the good restaurants there." Milo had never seen a stock ticker before, and the quotation for Egyptian cotton happened to be coming in just as he asked the head waiter to explain it to him.
"Egyptian cotton?" Milo said with that look of his. "How much is Egyptian cotton selling for?" The next thing I knew, he had bought the whole goddamn harvest, and now he can't unload any of it.
"He has no imagination. I can unload plenty of it in the black market if he'll make a deal."
"Milo knows the black market. There's no demand for cotton. But there is a demand for medical supplies. I can roll the cotton up on wooden toothpicks and peddle them as sterile swabs. Will he sell to me at a good price?"
"He won't sell to you at any price," Yusarian answered. "He's pretty sore at you for going into competition with him. In fact, he's pretty sore at everybody for getting diarrhea last weekend and giving his mess hall a bad name."
"Say, you can help us." Yusarian suddenly seized his arm. "Couldn't you forge some official orders on that mimeograph machine of yours and get us out of flying to Bologna?"
XPFC Wintergreen pulled away slowly with a look of scorn.
"Sure I could," he exclaimed with pride, "but I would never dream of doing anything like that."
"Why not?"
"Because it's your job. We all have our jobs to do. My job is to unload these Zippo lighters at a profit if I can and pick up some cotton from Milo. Your job is to bomb the ammunition dumps at Bologna."
"But I'm going to be killed at Bologna," Yusarian pleaded. "We're all going to be killed."
"Then you'll just have to be killed," replied XPFC Wintergreen. "Why can't you be a fatalist about it the way I am? If I'm destined to unload these lighters at a profit and pick up some Egyptian cotton sheep from Milo, then that's what I'm going to do. And if you're destined to be killed over Bologna, then you're going to be killed. So you might just as well go out and die like a man. I hate to say this, Yusarian, but you're turning into a chronic complainer."
Clevenger agreed with XPFC Wintergreen that it was Yusarian's job to get killed over Bologna, and was livid with condemnation when Yusarian confessed that it was he who had moved the bomb line and caused the mission to be cancelled.
"Why the hell not?" Yusarian snarled, arguing all the more vehemently because he suspected he was wrong. "Am I supposed to get my ass shot off just because the colonel wants to be a general?"
"What about the men on the mainland?" Clevenger demanded with just as much emotion. "Are they supposed to get their asses shot off just because you don't want to go? Those men are entitled to air support."
"But not necessarily by me. Look, they don't care who knocks out those ammunition dumps. The only reason we're going is because that bastard Cathcart volunteered us."
"Oh, I know all that," Clevenger assured him, his gaunt face pale and his agitated brown eyes swaying in sincerity. "But the fact remains that those ammunition dumps are still standing. You know very well that I don't approve of Colonel Cathcart any more than you do."
Clevenger paused for emphasis, his mouth quivering, and then beat his fist down softly against his sleeping bag. "But it's not for us to determine what targets must be destroyed, or who's to destroy them, or who gets killed doing it, and why?"
"Yes, even that. We have no right to question. You're insane. No right to question. Do you really mean that it's not my business how or why I get killed, and that it is Colonel Cathcart's? Do you really mean that?"
"Yes, I do," Clevenger insisted, seeming unsure. "There are men entrusted with winning the war who are in a much better position than we are to decide what targets have to be bombed."
"We are talking about two different things," Yusarian answered with exaggerated weariness. "You are talking about the relationship of the Air Corps to the infantry, and I'm talking about the relationship of me to Colonel Cathcart. You are talking about winning the war, and I am talking about winning the war and keeping alive."
"Exactly," Clevenger snapped smugly. "And which do you think is more important?"
To whom? The Assyrian shot back. Open your eyes, Clevenger. It doesn't make a damn bit of difference who wins the war to someone who's dead. Clevenger sat for a moment as though he'd been slapped. Congratulations, he exclaimed bitterly, the thinnest milk-white line enclosing his lips tightly in a bloodless squeezing ring. I can't think of another attitude that could be depended upon to give greater comfort to the enemy. The enemy, retorted the Assyrian with weighted precision, is anybody who's going to get you killed, no matter which side he's on, and that includes Colonel Cathcart. And don't you forget that, because the longer you remember it, the longer you might live.
Okay, but so this is where Clevenger, because he had the disciplinary action.
You mean the one way back when he was a cadet?
Yeah, and I think it really, yeah, I think they really punished him rather badly.
Wasn't his punishment was like standing guard on the weekends somewhere?
Yeah, I think, I don't know, I feel like it's because he's, that whole court situation really, I think, also burnt him. Yeah.
So the last thing was, don't you forget it, because the longer you remember it, the longer you might live, which I'm repeating because of this next line. But Clevenger did forget it, and now he was dead. At the time, Clevenger was so upset by the incident that Yusarian did not dare tell him he had also been responsible for the epidemic of diarrhea that had caused the other unnecessary postponement. Milo was even more upset by the possibility that someone had poisoned his squadron again, and he came bustling fretfully to Yusarian for assistance. Please find out from Corporal Snark if he put laundry soap in the sweet potatoes again, he requested furtively. Corporal Snark trusts you and will tell you the truth if you give him your word you won't tell anyone else. As soon as he tells you, come and tell me. Of course I put laundry soap in the sweet potatoes, Colonel Snark admitted to Yusarian. That's what you asked me to do, isn't it? Laundry soap is the best way. He swears to God he didn't have a thing to do with it, Yusarian reported back to Milo. Milo pouted dubiously. Dunbar says there is no God. Well, that's a bit of a... That came out of nowhere.
But I think Milo worships the ground Dunbar walks on kind of situation as well. He's got a bit of hero worship there.
Or maybe he trusted Yusarian to get to the bottom of it, and Yusarian's failed him, so he's like, ah, I guess there is no God. Milo also seems very dramatic.
Yes.
Mind you, so does Yusarian, but I can understand where Yusarian's coming from. Like, actually, just to go back to that conversation with Cathcart, the idea that your enemy is anyone who wants you dead, and that could be, like, the enemy in war, and it could be Colonel Cathcart. That's an interesting idea.
Yeah. It's interesting.
There was no hope left. By the middle of the second week, everyone in the squadron began to look like Hungry Joe, who was not scheduled to fly and screamed horribly in his sleep. He was the only one who could sleep. All night long, men moved through the darkness outside their tents like tongueless wraiths with cigarettes. In the daytime, they stared at the bomb line in futile, drooping clusters or at the still figure of Doc Danica sitting in front of the closed door of the medical tent beneath the morbid hand-lettered sign. They began to invent humorless, glum jokes of their own and disastrous rumors about the destruction awaiting them at Bologna. Yusarian sidled up drunkenly to Colonel Korn at the officers' club one night to kid with him about the new LePage gun that the Germans had moved in. What LePage gun? Colonel Korn inquired with curiosity. The new 344mm LePage glue gun, Yusarian answered. It glues a whole formation of planes together in midair. Colonel Korn jerked his elbow free from Yusarian's clutching fingers in startled affront. Let go of me, you idiot, he cried out furiously, glaring with vindictive approval as Nately leaped upon Yusarian's back and pulled him away. Who is that lunatic, anyway? Colonel Cathcart chortled merrily. That's the man you made me give a medal to after Ferreira. You had me promote him to captain, too, remember? It serves you right. Nately was lighter than Yusarian and had great difficulty maneuvering Yusarian's lurching bulk across the room to an unoccupied table. Are you crazy? Nately kept hissing with trepidation. That was Colonel Korn. Are you crazy? Yusarian wanted another drink and promised to leave quietly if Nately brought him one. Then he made Nately bring him two more. When Nately finally coaxed them to the door, Captain Black came stomping in from outside, banging his sloshing shoes down hard on the wood floor and spilling water from his eaves like a high roof. "Boy, are you bastards in for it," he announced exuberantly, splashing away from the puddle forming at his feet. "I just got a call from Colonel Korn. Do you know what they've got waiting for you at Bologna? Ha ha! They've got the new LePage glue gun. It glues the whole formation of planes together in midair." "My God, it's true!" Yessarian shrieked and collapsed against Nately in terror. "There is no God," answered Dunbar calmly, coming up with a slight stagger. "Hey, give me a hand with him, will you? I've got to get him back in his tent." "Says who?" "Says me. Gee, look at the rain. We've got to get a car." "Steal Captain Black's car," said Yessarian. "That's what I always do." "We can't steal anybody's car. Since you began stealing the nearest car every time you wanted one, nobody leaves the ignition on." "Hop in," said Chief White Half-Oak, driving up drunk in a covered jeep. He waited until they had crowded inside and then spurted ahead with a suddenness that rolled them all over backward. He roared with laughter at their curses. He drove straight ahead when he left the parking lot and rammed the car into the embankment on the other side of the road. The others piled forward in a helpless heap and began cursing him again. "I forgot to turn," he exclaimed. "Be careful, will you?" Nately cautioned. "You'd better put your headlights on." Chief White Half-Oat pulled back in reverse, made his turn, and shot away up the road at top speed. The wheels were sibilant on the whizzing blacktop surface. "Not so fast," urged Nately. "You'd better take me to your squadron first so I can help you put him to bed. Then you can drive me back to my squadron." "Who the hell are you?" "Dunbar." "Hey, put your headlights on," Nately shouted, "and watch the road." "They are on. Isn't Yessarian in this car? That's the only reason I let the rest of you bastards in." Chief White Half-Hope turned completely around to stare into the back seat. "Watch the road!" "Yessarian, is Yessarian in here?" "I'm here, Chief. Let's go home." "What makes you so sure? You never answered my question." "You see, I told you he was here." "What question?" "Whatever it was we were talking about." "Was it important?" "I don't remember if it was important or not. I wish to God I knew what it was." "There is no God." "That's what we were talking about," Yessarian cried. "What makes you so sure?" "Hey, are you sure your headlights are on?" Nately called out. "They're on, they're on. What does he want from me? It's all this rain on the windshield that makes it look dark from back there." "Beautiful, beautiful rain. I hope it never stops raining. Rain, rain, go away. Come again some other day. Little Yo-Yo wants to play in the meadow in." Chief White Half-Oat missed the next turn in the road and ran the jeep all the way up to the crest of a steep embankment. Rolling back down, the jeep turned over on its side and settled softly in the mud. There was a frightened silence. "Is everyone all right?" Chief White Half-Oat inquired in a hushed voice. No one was injured, and he heaved a long sigh of relief. "You know, that's my trouble," he groaned. "I never listened to anybody. Somebody kept telling me to put my headlights on, but I just wouldn't listen." "I kept telling you to put your headlights on." "I know, I know. And I just wouldn't listen, would I? I wish I had a drink." "I do have a drink. Look, it's not broken." "It's raining in," Nately noticed. "I'm getting wet." Chief White Half-Oak got the bottle of rye open, drank, and handed it off. Lying tangled up on top of each other, they all drank but Nately, who kept groping ineffectually for the door handle. The bottle fell against his head with a clunk, and whiskey poured down his neck. He began writhing convulsively. "Hey, we've got to get out of here," he cried. "We'll all drown." "Is anybody in there?" asked Clevenger with concern, shining a flashlight down from the top. "It's Clevenger," they shouted, and tried to pull him in through the window as he reached down to aid them. "Look at them," Clevenger exclaimed indignantly to McWatt, who sat grinning at the wheel of the staff car, "lying there like a bunch of drunken animals. You too, Nately. You ought to be ashamed. Come on, help me get them out of here before they all die in pneumonia." "You know, that don't sound like such a bad idea," Chief White Half-Oat reflected. "I think I will die of pneumonia." "Why?" "Why not?" answered Chief White Half-Oat, and lay back in the mud contentedly with a bottle of rye cuddled in his arms. "Oh, now look what he's doing," Clevenger exclaimed with irritation. "Will you get up and get into the car so we can all go back to the squadron?" "We can't all go back. Someone has to stay here to help the chief with his car he signed out of the motor pool." Chief White Half-Oat settled back in the staff car with an ebullient, prideful chuckle. "That's Captain Black's car," he informed them jubilantly. "I stole it from him at the officers' club just now with an extra set of keys he thought he lost this morning." "Well, I'll be damned. That calls for a drink. Haven't you had enough to drink? Clevenger began scolding as soon as McGuat started the car. Look at you. You don't care if you drink yourselves to death or drown yourselves to death, do you? Just as long as we don't fly ourselves to death. Hey, open it up, open it up, Chief White Halfoot urged McGuat. And turn off the headlights. That's the only way to do it. Dr. Nika is right, Clevenger went on. People don't know enough to take care of themselves. I really am disgusted with all of you. Okay, Fat Mouth, out of the car, Chief White Halfoat ordered. Everybody get out of the car but Ysarion. Where's Ysarion? Get the hell off me, Ysarion laughed, pushing him away. You're all covered with mud. Clevenger focused on Nately. You're the one who really surprises me. Do you know what you smell like? Instead of trying to keep him out of trouble, you get just as drunk as he is. Suppose he got in another fight with Appleby. Clevenger's eyes opened wide with alarm when he heard Ysarion chuckle. He didn't get into another fight with Appleby, did he? Not this time, said Dunbar. No, not this time. This time I did even better. This time he got in a fight with Colonel Korn. He didn't, gasped Clevenger. He did, exclaimed Chief White Halfoat with delight. That calls for a drink. But that's terrible, Clevenger declared with deep apprehension. Why in the world did you have to pick on Colonel Korn? Say, what happened to the lights? Why is everything so dark? I turned them off, answered McGuat. Sorry, it's like the ridiculousness of this whole scene is building and building.
Going, yeah.
I turned them off, answered McGuat. You know, Chief White Halfoat is right. It's much better with the headlights off. Yeah. Are you crazy? Clevenger screamed and lunged forward to snap the headlights on. He whirled around upon Ysarion in near hysteria. You see what you're doing? You've got them all acting like you. Suppose it stops raining and we have to fly to Bologna tomorrow. You'll be in fine physical condition. It won't ever gonna stop raining. No, sir. A rain like this really might go on forever. It has stopped raining, someone said, and the whole car fell silent. You poor bastards, Chief White Halfoot murmured compassionately after a few moments had passed. Did it really stop raining? Ysarion asked meekly. McGuat switched off the windshield wipers to make certain. The rain had stopped. The sky was starting to clear. The moon was sharp behind a gauzy brown mist. Oh, well, sang McGuat soberly. What the hell? Don't worry, fellas, Chief White Halfoat said. The landing strip is too soft to use tomorrow. Maybe it'll start raining again before the field dries out. You goddamn stinking lousy son of a bitch, Hungry Joe screamed from his tent as they sped into the squadron. Jesus, is he back here tonight? I thought he was still in Rome with the courier ship. Oh, 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 Hungry Joe screamed. Chief White Halfoat shuddered. That guy gives me the willies, he confessed in a grouchy whisper. Hey, whatever happened to Captain Flume? There's a guy that gives me the willies. I saw him in the woods last week eating wild berries. He never sleeps in his trailer anymore. He looked like hell. Hungry Joe's afraid he'll have to replace somebody who goes on sick call, even though there is no sick call. Did you see him the other night when he tried to kill Havermeyer and fell into Ysarian slit trench? Oh! Screamed Hungry Joe. Oh! 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 It sure is a pleasure not having Flume around in the mess hall anymore. No more of that pass the salt, Walt, or pass the bread, Fred, or shoot me a beet, Pete. Keep away! Keep away! Hungry Joe screamed. I said keep away! Keep away, you goddamn stinking lousy son of a bitch! At least we found out what he dreams about, Dunbar observed wryly. He dreams about goddamn stinking lousy sons of bitches. Late that night, Hungry Joe dreamed that Hubble's cat was sleeping on his face, suffocating him, and when he woke up, Hubble's cat was sleeping on his face. His agony was terrifying, the piercing, unearthly howl with which he split the moonlit dark, vibrating in its own impact for seconds afterward like a devastating shock. A numbing silence followed, and then a righteous din rose from inside his tent. Ysarion was among the first ones there. When he burst through the entrance, Hungry Joe had his gun out and was struggling to wrench his arm free from Hubble to shoot the cat, who kept spitting and feinting at him ferociously to distract him from shooting Hubble. Both humans were in their GI underwear. The unfrosted light bulb overhead was swinging crazily on its loose wire, and the jumbled black shadows kept swirling and bobbing chaotically, so that the entire tent seemed to be reeling. Ysarion reached out instinctively for balance and then launched himself forward in a prodigious dive that crushed the three combatants to the ground beneath him. he emerged from the melee with the scruff of a neck in each hand. Hungry Joe's neck and the cat's. Hungry Joe and the cat glared at each other savagely. The cat spat viciously at Hungry Joe, and Hungry Joe tried to hit it with a haymaker. A fair fight, Yessarian decreed, and all the others who had come running to the uproar in horror began cheering ecstatically in a tremendous overflow of relief. We'll have a fair fight, he explained officially to Hungry Joe and the cat after he had carried them both outside, still holding them apart by the scruffs of their necks, fists, fangs, and claws, but no guns, he warned Hungry Joe. And no spitting, he warned the cat sternly. When I turn you both loose, go. Break clean in the clinches and come back fighting. Go. There was a huge, giddy crowd of men who were avid for any diversion. But the cat turned chicken the moment Yessarian released him and fled from Hungry Joe ignominiously like a yellow dog. Hungry Joe was declared the winner. He swaggered away happily with the proud smile of a champion, his shriveled head high and his emaciated chest out. He went back to bed victorious and dreamed again that Hubble's cat was sleeping on his face, suffocating him.
Okay.
Oh, boy. That was,
It was something.
That was a chapter.
That scene there was Hungry Joe had his gun out, was struggling to wrench his arm free from Hubble to shoot the cat, who kept spitting and fainting at him, ferociously distracted from shooting Hubble.
And it's funny because I think right at the start of the chapter talked about the time Hungry Joe fought a cat, and I'm like, I do love how Heller will just sprinkle like a sentence in there that makes you go, wait, what? I guess we'll find out about it.
And builds up, yeah. Oh, it's fascinating.
But I think this is also where we learned where Hungry Joe got his idea of wanting to... Chief White Halfo got his idea of wanting to die of pneumonia.
Yes. So we're slowly getting a little bit more happening.
It was really weird where Yessarian was talking BS to Colonel Korn about the glue gun, and then somehow Captain Black comes in with the idea of the glue gun. Did, like, Colonel Court call headquarters?
Yeah, well, we know how they work. They get told the line, oh, we've conquered it. So, we've conquered. So, therefore, they have the same situation where they believe whatever they're told.
Now, I think I have this straight. Correct me if I'm wrong, if you understand it. I get the idea that, so Clevenger thought the whole idea of, you know, sneaking up in the middle of the night to move the line, so they thought that Bellona would be already freed, was superstitious. And Yessarian agreed, and then that night he did it.
It was other way around. He was saying, they're being really superstitious. It makes no sense. I mean, short of, it's as silly as, it would be just as silly as to do that. Like, if you move the line on the map, as though that's going to make a difference to the actual reality. So he was saying cause and effect. So staring at the line is not going to make it move. You know, it's that they have
someone
to have...
Someone has to come in and move.
No. He was saying that even if you physically move the line, it's not going to change the reality of what's happening on the infantry. So he was talking about cause and effects. Like they're staring at the map as though even if that map changed, them staring at it is going to cause a change. Or even if someone came in and moved it, it wouldn't make a difference because it's not what's reflecting the reality of what's happening on the ground.
But then Yessarian did go in and move it. And
yeah.
That's what led to Captain Black thinking that they'd already won Bellona, and then the medal got passed around with the whole General Treadle.
Yeah, so Clevenger is right that in reality it shouldn't change anything. But the way that it's being portrayed here is that Yessarian understands just how messed up the communication is amongst the army, and how it's like, there's just really poor how poorly the military does these things, and also he's taking advantage of the fact that Captain Black really has no idea what he's doing.
But Clevenger was right, because even with all the pat yourself on the back, we all get medals, everyone's thinking higher above their station, it still seems that Bologna is going ahead no matter what.
No, because Bologna wasn't going to go ahead. I don't know. This is not in the same order. This is not the same order. So that argument he has with Clevenger is after the drunk night with the accident.
Right.
Yeah. It's afterwards that Ysarion says, yeah, I actually did the thing.
You know, that's probably part of my issue. Silly me reading things in a chronological fashion.
Yeah, it didn't add together. Why would Colonel Korn, what's the point of Colonel Korn being there? What's the point of any of them there being around the officers that they know that they've doomed to flight when they're trying to pat each other on the back because it's already been conquered? So, of course, it's been cancelled. So there's a sequence. It doesn't make sense sequentially. But it makes sense if the drunken night where Ysarion decided to do weird things with Colonel Korn, like that would have happened before. The whole moving the line and Ysarion getting to the point where, because remember they were saying the rain is rain, it stopped raining. It was after it had stopped raining that suddenly that line moved.
I'm now a little adrift because now that you quite rightly pointed out that see in the previous chapters when we jumped around, I think it was a lot more obvious, but maybe I was so caught up in reading that time that it just felt all chronological to me. And now that I realize it's not, I've kind of hit a stumbling block.
I think we have to find out. Like, we'll find out more. We'll find out what's happened. I don't think we've heard the last of Bologna. I think that was just giving us a little snippet of it.
Well, we know, I'm pretty sure it's that Bologna mission that Clevenger dies on.
Probably. Or something to do with a mission before or around it. Because we also have a mission where there's people we still haven't figured out which mission it was that those officers went on that led to Major being appointed.
And there it was even mentioned there how Ysarion got a medal for the Ferrera mission, which I think that was the one where the guy who's the dead man in his tent, who's not there, but, you know, doesn't officially exist. I think that's the one he died on.
I think so. It was either that one, and then there was another one, which was
Avignon.
Avignon. And Avignon, I think, was the one where there was his co-pilot or someone died.
Yeah.
The navigator. He's a navigator, so one of them died. Yeah, it's a mess. Yeah. I think at the end of this, I'm going to sit down and figure out and read through the sequential thing, and then it'll make more sense.
But like in the moment, I'm still like, I loved those conversations that happened. There was still some wonderful prose. I think Hiller's got a real way with picking the right words to express the situation.
The chaos, basically. Yeah, he's very good at it.
I'm also going back to, I mentioned it as we were reading that conversation he had with Clevenger, Ysarion had with Clevenger, where Clevenger is having a go at him for, you know, not wanting to fly to Bologna. And just like Wintergreen said, you know, but that's your job. And that's kind of the tech that Clevenger was making is, you know, you are part of the Air Force. It is your duty to go on these missions. Yeah. And at this point, Ysarion's like, no, F that, man. I don't want to die.
Yeah, no, and he's also rightfully pointing out, it's like, who's your enemy if your enemy isn't your enemy the person who wants you dead?
And also, I think it's a very selfish sentiment, but I don't think it's an incorrect one where he talks about, look, because Clevenger, like before, he brings up the idea, well, you have a defeatist attitude. That attitude, you're making sound like you want the enemy to win, like you don't want to win the war. He's like, no, it's a different thing. If I don't fly this mission, there are other people who can fly this mission. The selfish reason being, and I think Clevenger rightly points out, like with the infantryman, it's like, yeah, but then other people will be dying in your place. You think that's fair? And Ysarion kind of like, well, yeah, because I'm not dying.
Yeah, and that's where the selfishness comes in. But is at the same time, no one would have to die if they didn't actually. So yeah, it's a bit of a mess.
I'm sympathetic to Ysarion completely, but I also recognize he is being selfish.
And at the same time, when you also don't feel like your death is actually going to make a difference in terms of the war, then why wouldn't you?
Yeah, the idea of a meaningless death, you know, before we started reading, we were talking about the idea of legacy and purpose. And it does seem that, I don't know, it does, well, it feels like just where purpose has to come with from within, meaning has to come from within. Almost like, well, if Yusarin truly believed he was fighting for a righteous cause, then also, his death might not matter.
Yeah, but it's not just that. I think he's also been there long enough to go, this doesn't actually make any sense. I'm just here for the egos of others.
Yes,
and
yes.
And that's because I think that gets mentioned, like it is all about the squabbling over medals and whatnot. Like it's not...
And what, you know, there are the true believers. Alfie is one of the... Not Alfie, it's Nately, right? Nately's the Iowa boy.
Not Nately.
I thought Nately was the Iowa
not
boy.
Not Nately, no.
Because that's why, no, I think that's why Clevenger Appleby. Said, I'm very disappointed in you, Nately.
No, Appleby.
Appleby, right.
Nately is...
Was he Yusarin's navigator?
Nately or Appleby? Hmm. Nately?
Yeah.
No, Nately, I think, was...
I thought he was in the plane with Yusarin as well when we went to that brief part of Avignon.
Possibly.
I think this is the problem, folks. Yeah, there's too many characters. There's too many things that happen, and it's all told out of order. So, like, we are sincerely questioning each other, Nately hoping that it sparks the right answer.
I think Nately was kind. Like, Nately was nice, a nice kid. But it was, like, he was sincere, but he was just, like, he wanted to be there and get out. Whereas, I don't think he was actually... as big a he wasn't that he was an excessively patriotic person. It's just he did his job and he did it well.
Appleby is definitely the patriotic one.
Him and what's his name?
Well, Alfie just doesn't understand that he's in a war, it seems.
Alfie's just he's just a pompous and ignorant and just completely
oblivious. We have talked about Clevenger like holding on to the idea of duty because he's got nothing left anymore.
Yes, because he's highly intellectual. He's an intellectual, and he's just trying to... He's holding on to some sort of reasoning or purpose in order to stay sane as much as he can. But that's... Anyway, next chapter will be about Major Blank de Coverley, so that will be interesting.
Maybe we get to find out how he lost his eye. Maybe we get to find out why he's so respected. Maybe we get the loyalty oath dissolution from his point of view.
Mm-hmm. Be fascinating.
And we're about a third through the book now.
Yes, excellent.
I remember.
Nately is the guy who has a lady friend whom Captain Black competes for the affections of.
Have we learned that in book?
Yes.
Was he the one who went to the house of ill repute? So I don't say that word.
The lady friend.
No, it was Dunbar who had the kid sister in the...
No, it wasn't Dunbar.
It was Nately.
Nately.
It wasn't, okay.
Not Dunbar. Dunbar, so far, the only things we've really had is the hospital and his interaction with the doctor and his interactions with Yusarin, mainly.
And wasn't it the ditch digging, because he had a very interesting view of time, and the more boring things were, the more he enjoyed.
No, that wasn't him.
I'm pretty sure that was Dunbar.
No, Dunbar, the ditch digging was Wintergreen.
No, the ditch digging,
and
but there was a...
Or, what's his name? I think it's Orr, whatever his name is. The guy who's the tent mate with Yusarin. He's the one who built the moat or the ditch or whatever. He likes ditch digging.
There was that scene where Dunbar talked about his views on time. I think they were digging ditches. Or maybe it was the horseshoe game.
Maybe the horseshoe game. Maybe.
See, this is the problem. I don't think I can hold it all in my head.
No, can't find it. It's all good. I'm sure it will make sense. But yes, so... Yes.
And let me reiterate, I have read this book before. It was like a decade ago, but like, you know, when Rue read through Anna Green Gables, she'd read that book probably not for a while, and she remembered everything.
No, I've reread it every couple of years. I tend to reread that one. So that one's one that I'll remember. But Northanger Abbey, less so. That was vaguely cool. Not always. Like, I forgot about that.
The beats of 1984 and Brave New World, I'd pretty much remembered as they were happening.
This one's not one that you can't. Like, it's just too many. Too much going on.
It really does feel like you have to do like a thesis on this book to put it all together.
I'm sure someone has. I'm sure they have, as we saw the analysis that's out there.
But I'll tell you this, and this is from experience because I have read the book I'm about to say. This is a lot easier to parse than Ulysses.
Yes, that makes
for
sense.
For one, it's written in a more modern language.
Well, yes. There's that.
James Joyce was a poet. I think that's half the reason that Ulysses is so difficult to parse. But he also wrote that book that way on purpose.
Yes, most likely. I can't make myself
There's a wonderful quote, and I'm going to paraphrase it because I'm going to butcher it. But he purposely made that book so full of reference points and multiple interpretations because he wanted academics to be dissecting his work for years, and he said that's the only way I can think of to achieve immortality.
That's one, right? That's what we're talking about, legacy again. Oh, dear, dear. In the meantime, in terms of legacy, we can only leave our name to a point and hope that our name lasts to a point, but, I mean, if that's someone's idea of legacy, sure.
Oh. And on that point, actually, I'll just relate this story before we head off. There is a book I read last year called Sum, S-U-M, and it is 40 short stories, each one a different idea about what happens when you die from a multitude of different perspectives. And the one of them that kind of stuck with me the most is the idea that, you know that I think it's saying that we're never truly dead as long as someone remembers our name.
Mm.
Well, it's kind of the dark side of that sentiment. Whereas when you die, you head to a purgatory, kind of. You're unable to move on from the space until you are completely forgotten from this life. So, the idea is that probably Shakespeare will be hanging out in that space for millennia because his work is still caught and taught, and he's regarded as, one of the great authors. But that idea that you are unable to move on until you've finally forgotten from this plane of existence.
Mm. That would be cruel. Very, very cruel. Very cruel. Fun,
yeah.
But cruel.
Yeah, I think I really appreciated the dark turn on that sentiment of leaving legacy behind or being remembered.
Yes. Could you imagine?
And most of the other stories of that book, I really did enjoy. I think it's worth a read. I do recommend that. But until next week, I think we'll wrap up now. The music at the top of the podcast was Soap Runs by Rupert Gregson-Williams and Harry Gregson-Williams. It's from the 2019 adaptation of Catch-22. The music at the end of the podcast is I'm the Slime by Frank Zappa. You can find me over on Twitter at Dave_the_turnip.
And you can find me at Roo McMoo, that's R-O-O-M-C-M-O-O, on Twitter. You can find our podcast at SMBSLT Podcast, that's on Twitter, on Facebook. And if you add @gmail.com, you have our email address. Feel free to let us know about what you, so far, if you've been reading any of these books that we've covered, and if you have any suggestions for future books and future ideas, everything is, we welcome any feedback. We appreciate it.
If you are as confused by what's been happening in Catch-22, if you've been following along with us, please let us know. Let us know we're not alone in this.
Yes. It's all good.
But until next week, happy reading all, stay safe, and we'll see you next time.
Okay.